Blog Talk Radio.
All right, you're listening to RSG One Mic, and tonight we go deep into the life of a baller, the baller life, tonight on One Mic.
Log Talk Radio.
This thing right here,
yeah.
It's for my people in the streets.
Yes, today. You know, as we start this show, this One Mic.
We
There is a pause throughout the stadium as this man sounds like he just coughs up a lung. They're looking around the Jumbotron shows and fans, the cheerleaders, and as it goes down each cheerleader's face, each one breaks up into laughter, which at this particular time destroys half the stadium. The other half is still trying to figure out what the hell just happened. Does this guy need CPR or something? And then at that particular time, I lost it. Devon Ruff.
Yes. Today,
Love Talk Radio.
This show, this One Mic.
Phoenix is another place. They got a great training staff. I mean, they were able to breathe life back into Shaq. And if you can do that, you know, people talk a lot about their training staff.
Yes, today, you know, as we start this show, this One Mic.
All right, welcome to RSG's version of One Mic. This is the show where we take a topic deep, some of the hottest topics in sports, and we go deep throughout our entire podcast. This is the topic we talk about. It's different than our big show. Our big show is like the intersection between what I would call a faculty seminar in the barbershop, but you never know what's going to happen. And also, if you have a chance to listen to Hustle and Flow, that's like that intersection between hip-hop and sports. And so, but tonight, you know, we're going to go deep into what we're talking about is the baller life. LaVar Ball is, he created quite a ripple effect in sports. A lot of topics, a lot of things to be unpacked. But we hope to dig deeper in ways that you probably haven't heard on other sports platforms regarding this topic. And for me to do that, it was important for me to bring one of my good partners, and I would say he's a sports enthusiast, but you know, his training is he's an economist who brings that perspective. He's a longtime educator and has helped an incredibly number of folks navigate through the educational system. But he's also has his own non-for-profit, started his own business to impact the leadership development of college students, particularly in the Black Student Union, and impacting those students. And so he's done a lot of different work, and we hope that that expertise can help us dig a little bit deeper on what is really happening with LaVar Ball and the Ball family. And it's my guy, Dr. Richard McGregory Jr. How you doing, sir?
Doing fine. Thanks for having me on. Great to be in the conversation.
Now, you know, it's important for folks before we get in, because you're going to hit us with, you know, some deep stuff, and you and I talk about this stuff all the time, and I'm just excited for folks to get, you know, to hear you speak about this, because I think you bring a really important perspective to this issue. But, you know, you're a Cowboys fan, and
yes.
I know you've been living and dying with your boys, and they've broken your heart, but they made a run last year. And then they try to make some solid picks. I see they got my guy from Michigan, Taco Carlton, and so they got some things going on down there. So how do you feel about your Cowboys right now?
I feel better about them than I have in a long time. Not only because of how the season went last year, but because they're breaking out of old mentality. For a long time, they wouldn't give a quarterback like a Dak Prescott an opportunity. For a long time, they were locked into to a model really that looked at how do you replicate the triplets of the 1990s versus coming with a new paradigm in terms of how you're going to operate for a long time, they seemed like they just didn't want to adapt to the modern times. Even some of the more what I would call risky personnel decisions, at least now they're willing to take a chance on some players. Now, some of it has not worked out, but at least they're trying to lead with talent, where before seemed like they were more concerned about marketing the stadium than really trying to lead with talent.
Do you think that's more with the kind of the emergence of, you know, Stephen Jones and, you know, his ability? I always said that, you know, you got to find somebody that Jerry Jones is going to can get him to slow down. And it seemed like that draft when they picked Fredericks, who when they did the top 100 was the only interior lineman, I think the only center that was ranked in the top 100 players for the NFL this year, this past, when they surveyed all the players. You know, this is a person when they picked him in the first round out of Wisconsin, who was, I think, the first lineman to start as a freshman at Wisconsin, a place that produces a lot of linemen. You know, that pick was, you know, Jerry was trying to go get Johnny Manziel, and it was almost like they had to tie him down, hog tie him, you know, while they got that pick in. So do you think the emergence of Steven in that role has helped to kind of stabilize and bring a different kind of focus to, you know, an approach to the way the Cowboys have worked?
Oh, definitely, because I think Jerry is more of a marketing genius and guru, so he knows how to put the sizzle. Cowboys fans were frustrated because there was no steak under the sizzle. And you only build a football team by having solid lines. Then that allows you to bring in the skilled players and have them operate. And I think Steven realized that, and he was in a good position because due to close relationships with the owner and general manager, he couldn't get fired.
That's right. He wasn't going to fire because Jerry had to go talk to Mama. You know, so
right,
you know,
right.
So yeah, we have to keep an eye on that. Well, hey man, I'm glad to have you here. This is One Mic, where on this platform we dig deep on issues. We're brought, all callers and hosts are brought to you by CarbonWorld Health, the total fitness and lifestyle solution. Please go to CarbonWorldHealth.com and let Dr. Rodriguez and the staff over there know that the RSG folks sent you there. This podcast is a little bit different. We're digging deep on this single topic, and our topic tonight is the ball of life, talking about the Ball family and, you know, the ripple that LeVar Ball has, you know, done across the sports world landscape, creating a lot of debate and conversation around what's happening with them and the impact on their son Lonzo and the other sons in terms of what they're doing, and this idea of building the Baller brand. And so we thought we'd bring in, you know, Dr. Richard McGregory Jr., who is an economist, and as well as an educator, has worked in both higher education and in K-12 systems, and has owned not-for-profit, has done a number of community work and labor economists, and so to bring, as well as a sports enthusiast, so can bring a different perspective to it. And that's one thing about One Mic, is that we like to bring experts, you know, like Dr. McGregory onto the show and other folks coming out of different ones to provide some insight that you might not hear on other platforms. And so we're going to dig deep in here regarding, you know, what's happening and kind of take back some of the layers, because I think for the most part, you know, a lot of these platforms has been very surface conversation about this. You know, shout out to Marcus and Phil. We've been through texting. We've been going back and forth. And, you know, Marcus definitely has a position on this in a way. In some ways, Marcus has been concerned because, you know, the fact that LeVar may have cost his son at least about $10 million, you know, maybe 20, in endorsement deals. But there's something else underground going on here that I think needs to be kind of played out. So, you know, one of the things I'm going to do is kind of just, you know, ask Dr. McGregory, you know, some some things I've just been kind of thinking about, and I think you definitely have, I would say, a perspective on some of these issues. To kind of unpack this a little bit deeper than I think most people have been thinking about this. And so, maybe I'll start with this question. One of the things that's kind of bothered me about the conversation, and I posted this on Facebook in response to a post that I saw, and it was a great exchange around this, is that there seems to be a disconnect between the concept of ownership that LeVar Ball is talking about in terms of the purpose of why he made the decision, and in this idea around the current compensation model that's being offered by shoe companies to athletes, where there's this perception of loss, but LeVar is really he's coming at this in a different way because he's talking about ownership and other people are talking about loss. Can you unpack some of the issues that are there and what people may be missing, aside from the delivery of LeVar Ball in terms of how he delivers his message, but what's fundamentally being missed by this concept that he's talking about ownership versus the current way in which shoe deals are done for athletes?
And I was really looking at the concept of what type of capital do you want to participate in the market, where historically athletes have been seen as providing human capital, and that capital is used by the companies in order to either produce a product or sell a product or promote a product. And then once they're not able to deliver that human capital anymore because they're not as famous or they're not playing anymore, then things kind of go away. Looks like LeVar Ball, despite what we might think about his execution of his plan, he wants to move into the sphere where he is the owner of capital. And so when he talks about the co-branding, means that he's talking about co-ownership. And he's talking about really getting his family in the entrepreneurial space. I think it's a very interesting topic because many things that people have not, at least to my hearing, talked about relate to the fact that LeVar went to college. And anytime you have a college experience and you are exposed to different models and theories and what have you, then you start to think about how can you participate at a different level in the society as a citizen, as a business person, as a worker. And his thinking might also be about where are his three sons going to end up in that space? Are they going to forever have a mentality where they're solely a worker, or are they going to move to the point where they're being entrepreneurial? And in order for them to be entrepreneurial, do they have to wait to kind of do like an apprenticeship under a company, or can they launch an entrepreneurial venture right away? One thing that I also was thinking about when you think about the timing is we don't really know how Lonzo is going to pan out as a player. And so what happens if he's not as good a player as many people think that he's going to be? This might be their one shot to launch this and to get those experiences and take the risk and really operate on a different level of exploiting capital. Or say he's really good. Then you directly start making the money, and you don't have to then navigate through a longer-term contract with a shoe company in order to go to another entrepreneurial plane. So from both sides of it, I can see some merits to LeVar's thinking. And again, I think it's an interesting case study about how do you move in society to having a greater level of participation. And what could it do to teach your sons about risk-taking, about the concept of ownership, and about owning your own brand, not just being a brand that's exploited by others, but owning your own brand. And also think that it sends a message to the to communities of color and communities where they have folks who are often marginalized about are there some different models that you could utilize with and really then try to impact your community in terms of this level of economic development and development of overall capital.
Yeah, and I love that point you made because, you know, one of the things, the points that a counterpoint that I made when I was kind of going back and forth on Facebook was some of the importance of this from specifically communities of color, and particularly black communities, where you have a economic system where the dollar hardly circulates through the community. And a part of that is around there's a lack of ownership in communities. And so there's this culture of being in the workforce but not having ownership. And what comes along with that, there was a great YouTube video I watched with Dame Dash on The Breakfast Club, and he was trying to explain that concept to folks. You know, and you had cats in there who were doing pretty well. But the thing he said is that you got to be here at 6:30 in the morning. If you're not here at 6:30 in the morning, no matter how much money you make, they can fire you. Whereas I can get up when I want to get up. And I might not be producing money at the level, but I have a level of freedom. And what that means in terms of economic development and growth in a community, one of the things that I raised in a class a couple of years ago, I think Bronson was in this class, Kenny was in this class. I said, if you Google the number of players out of Detroit proper that went to the NBA, just deal with the NBA, and you look at that list, and you look at how much money those individuals made, why is there only one Jalen Rose Academy in Detroit? You know, what benefit did the city get? And so when you think about the mindset, you know, some people think about the money, but I think one of the things you're describing is there's a mindset to understanding your position and controlling the capital, earning and leading and being a participant as an owner versus being in partnership and being, you know, really an employee with no real decision on price. Like the funniest thing when people said to him, you know, why'd you put the price at that point? He said, well, as an owner, I can decide what the price point is. And that's what I thought the price point was going to be. Now, you could debate whether or not that's a good strategy or not. But what they missed is what he was talking about, the freedom to decide that. And he said, I bet you Michael Jordan didn't get the chance to sit in the room and decide on the price point. Like, there is a concept there that people miss. And so can you unpack that? Because, I mean, that right there, to me, that was such a powerful line that people missed that is kind of away from some of the other things that people miss. Like, can you break that down, why that's important? Because that was an important kind of part of the conversation that I think people missed when he said that.
Yeah, I agree totally with his – LeVar saying that he wanted to be able to have a say, to have a voice. I mean, part of the reason why you even had things like union movements in the country was to give workers a voice. But one of the best ways to have a voice is, rather than you demanding a voice through protests and what have you, is that you have a seat at the ownership table. Then that way you can decide on how the product's going to look. What is it going to be priced at? How is the packaging? And it also gives you an opportunity to experiment. And as you're experimenting and learning more from your trial and error and things like that, then that will strengthen you on even your next entrepreneur venture. I think you see some of the frustration in urban areas and minority communities is that you have a lot of talent that is suppressed because of whatever constraints or choices or whatever reasons that you might give, folks never get a chance to participate in those types of decisions. Their decision-making might be which company to interview for. There might be some chance to be in a higher level discussions when you're doing things like negotiating your salary, but after you've negotiated your salary and your terms of work, then you still have a certain amount of constraint. I remember reading an article several years ago about Junior Bridgman when he was first thinking about transitioning from the NBA into the business world, and he was part of the labor rep team for the NBA players, and how cavalier he felt the owners were about what was going on. And then as he got a little bit closer to seeing the owners, he realized the way they could be cavalier is that ultimately they own the teams. And so the players who didn't have ownership, they were going to come and go. The owners were going to be more permanent. And so that led Bridgman into trying to leverage his money into the next sphere, so then that way he could participate at that level. And he says that he made much more money as an entrepreneur from his experiences dealing with the owners as a labor rep than he ever made as a player. And that has ramifications for minority communities, because when you have a mentality where you're a worker, you can help some people get employed because you might move to a supervisory role. But as an owner, you have the potential, if things go right, to have a much bigger say on employment. You have a much bigger say about social policy, about tax policy. You have a different type of relationships with the politicians, to where you can talk about the need for resources to be distributed in different manners. You can directly shape policy because you're controlling employment, you're controlling in terms of tax revenue, and so it's a totally different sphere of participation. I even see that Michael Jordan was kind of someone who as he really became an entrepreneur after being a player, it helped him finally even find his voice politically, whereas more recently he had some things to say about the situations about the police with unarmed African-American motorists and what have you, whereas when he was asked to weigh in about possibly helping elect an African-American for a congressional seat, when he's in playing days, he didn't want to touch it because he said that Republicans bought tennis shoes too. And so he couldn't find his voice when he was under those constraints, whereas as an entrepreneur, he's been more able to find his own voice.
You listen to RSG One Mic, the show where we go deep into sports topics, and our topic tonight on One Mic is baller life. We're talking about LeVar Ball and the Ball family. And you know, the national conversation that's kind of emerged around this issue. I'm here with Dr. Richard McGregor Jr., who's an economist, educator, but more importantly, he is a sports fan. You know, one of the things that we love about our Real Sports Guys contributor in our network, that all of us are in all these different walks of life, but are in on our sports and can talk about this. And if you haven't had a chance to, if you're just kind of jumping in, definitely catch this podcast on iTunes. Just look for Real Sports Guys. You can also go to realsportsguys.com. You can go to Blog Talk Radio and search for Real Sports Guys. And then you can get us on all our platforms on Real Sports Guys, on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram. And then you can get me, RSG D. Wills, on Twitter, on Instagram, and Facebook as well, if you want to continue this conversation beyond this. But, yes, we're talking about LeVar Ball, what I call the baller life, the way in which, you know, these things shift. You know, it almost feels like the moment, you and I noticed from a hip-hop standpoint, you know, you remember the reaction to Hammer when Hammer was doing all that commercialized stuff. You know, when he was in the Pepsi commercial, when he had the cartoon, and the way in which he got ostracized in a way, and then that just became the norm. You know, even your most street set connected guys coming through were beginning to look at some of those deals, or you see a Missy Elliott or whatever you might see, or anybody. It just became the norm in hip hop. And in some ways, I feel like, you know, that first iteration, like it did for Hammer, right? Created all that reaction, and somebody's got to go through that for people to see the possibilities. What was interesting, even about the conversation today, you and I talked about this off air. It was interesting for me to listen to Mike and Mike this morning because, you know, Mike Golic and Mike Greenberg have had different perspectives. And part of what I told you is that part of their perspective has a lot to do with their origin. You know, and it was hard. I think Greeny was trying to come up with a point, but part of it is Greeny came from a household where his family owned a store. They were in a community of, in a culture of ownership, right? And you can really talk about how their origins shaped their voice in terms of this issue, whereas Greenberg has this different perspective. And you and I talked about this, about that. Can you talk a little bit about how you saw some of that? Because I thought it was interesting because I think – it gives an example of how people's backgrounds inform how they see this issue.
And I just saw Mike Greenberg coming from a family where there was an entrepreneurial venture, thought about things in terms of being an entrepreneur, having a certain level of freedom to determine some possibilities in the economic realm, where Mike Golic, even though he's been successful and what have you, has primarily – approach things from the lens of a worker, and so the worker lens doesn't always conceptualize the freedoms and as well as the risks and what have you associated with owning your own venture. I think one of the reasons, even when I was deciding to study economics, was I remember talking to my grandfather, who always had a small entrepreneur venture on the side from his job in Gary, Indiana, growing up. And I always noticed that when he had his own entrepreneur venture, you know, he always could give you a product out of it. You know, when he had the corner store, you could always get a soda and things like that. And so it was a different conversation than just a conversation where I'm going to a job. And so, I think that experience particularly has impacted Greenberg, and where he can see what they're trying to do, because there's a level of freedom and there's a level of being very American about what LeVar is trying to do. We talk about this is a country that will allow you to kind of create your own destiny. And so when we see someone really saying, well, I'm going to go ahead and test it, because this is a country that says that anyone can go and do this if they have, you know, the ability to work hard, the ability to come up with a concept. And what he's doing is very American. I always think about when working with students in TRIO programs, how the level of conversation always had to be, not only could you get the marketable skills to work for someone, but for a segment who really wanted to do something different, well, how could you leverage your skills to doing something for yourself? And I remember having conversations with students over the years where some of them had the mentality, I would rather have 20% of what I could get working for someone else if I could work for myself and call my own shots. And I think Greenberg understands that from the family background, and I think Golic, and his experiences, doesn't understand it in the same kind of light.
I think you hit it right on the head. And you know, when we're having this conversation about, you know, athletes' rights, we're asking about empowerment. You know, one of the things that you know is very important part about this conversation. You and I have had this even when we're talking about social justice issues. That part of social justice is economic justice. And so part of this is that conversation we're having around this. And when we have athletes who are accruing wealth in this way and how they leverage it, you know, LeBron, I think, has been the best at it. He found a really good balance between leveraging some of the normal approaches to doing this and then using that as seed money to do it. And I would say Golic raised that as an issue as well. Golic was like, you know, take the first deal and use it. So I would give him credit around that. But, you know, so But the idea of the ownership mentality, I think Shaq has always had that. Shaq has always had that. You know, even when he worked with the NBA and everything, I mean, Shaq has always seen, it felt like he didn't have an agent he was responding to. All these people were working for Shaq. Shaq was the CEO from the beginning, and he drove all of his ventures that way. And in a way that, you know, sometimes people got so caught up in the antics, but they weren't seeing the game plan laid out. I mean, think about it. He's retired, and look at the number of commercials he's already doing. Look at how many other ventures he's doing. He's been every time you turn around, he's going to China. You know, he has always been that kind of ownership mindset, and always been empowered in ways that allow you to know you can walk away from the game in a way. And so it's been interesting to kind of talk about that. You know, people are so focused on the money, they're not focused on the mindset that we're talking about, which is different. That in some ways, that's the stuff that also contributes to your health and wellness, to know that you can do that. It's not just having $1 million. You know, like Biggie said, more money, more problems. So it's not just about that, but do you have ownership?
And I think it's a natural evolution, because you think about musically, where when you had artists like Prince, who their big struggle was to have ownership. I think even in the movie Ray, one of the big points of the career of Ray Charles was when he was able to negotiate the contract, and he was able to get control over a certain percentage of his own masters. You know, I think of even the about a 10 album apprenticeship that LL Cool J had to do before he was able to get royalties from his masters, right? And, you know, and the contract that he signed with Def Jam as a high school dropout at 16 years old.
That's right.
But I see also then there being a level of resistance about LeVar Ball saying, well, maybe my son doesn't have to do that.
Yes.
And so some people say, well, he's destroying his son's career. We don't really know those household dynamics, because they might be willing to bet on themselves. And when we look at how many players who made big money who wind up destitute, maybe doing an entrepreneur venture will even help Lonzo understand the cost of a dollar. And hopefully it might shape how he manages the money that he makes that's outside of the shoe branding.
So one thing I want to ask, because that point right there, so because I want you to dig into, so you know, people might be saying, you know, you listen to One Mic. This is Devon Wilson. I'm here with Dr. Richard McGregory Jr., who is an economist, educator, and I would say sports enthusiast, because he can talk about sports as well as anybody. But tonight we're talking about a baller's life. We're talking about the Ball family and, you know, the model that they're trying to develop that has kind of created this national conversation. But we're brought to you by Carbon Well Health. Go to carbonwellhealth.com. Let Dr. Rodriguez and the staff there know that the Real Sports Guy sent you. They are there for the total health and beauty solution. So check them out over there and let them know that they sent it. They've been pushing me and on me, and if you've been following me on social media, you know I'm changing a little bit. Body's trying to go down. It's been a journey. So it's been great to have them on there. And I know he's probably listening, because I just sent him a tweet and said you know, Dr. McGregor was killing it. He was like, oh, he was loving it. So we have to get him on at some point. But part of what I want to get into, because I do think there's an evolution to entrepreneurship. And, you know, even when I started to launch Real Sports Guys, when you launch something, you really there's a sense of, like, control. It's like almost like a relationship. And one of the things that, you know, you and our good friend XL Lewis, who's really good about, like, he's got a great business mind, and he really works through this. You know, one of the things he often talks about is that you can't get so romantically tied to it. And it can't be about, you talk about this a lot. And that really success is a team sport in that, you know, even though you have a visionary who's driving it, you know, I think the best people over time put the pieces around them. When you look at the where LeVar Ball is, you know, there's a discussion of whether or not he's, you know, he's Kris Jenner trying to do the Kardashian thing, or is he trying to run this billion-dollar business? And I think you and I were talking about offline that in some ways, so two things. How do you get somebody like that, particularly in some of the communities we're talking about, to understand the approach to building that kind of brand? Because I think that's what LeBron taught people. Like, LeBron spent time, he got a PhD in business. He spent some time with people like Warren Buffett, you know, Jay-Z and others, where, you know, they and his crew really understood how the game was set up. It feels like they studied it, and they got a PhD in it, right? And that part of the game appears to be missing with LeVar Ball. And we often see in communities that we're talking about where that's the part that keeps a micro business, right? It doesn't allow it to become, you know, a medium size and grow to a multinational company. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I would say that that's often one of the challenges when I've studied some of the businesses in African-American or urban communities. Often you have a disconnect sometimes between those with an entrepreneur mindset and those who possess some of the typical skills needed to run the day-to-day operations of a business. And one of the challenges is how do you get those two different abilities to merge? So then that way they can work together in a complementary fashion so you don't only have a great idea, but you also have someone who's at the store open when it's supposed to be opened, people with the right amount of working capital, the proper ratios in terms of your employee costs compared to your profits. And so you got to have all of that, and you typically don't have all of that in one person. And part of the challenge is to be able to have that entrepreneur be able to work in a framework by which they're able to connect with other people of expertise, so then that way everyone can specialize in what they do best and really have not only great ideas but also a level of efficiency and effectiveness, so that way you can turn a good concept into sustainable profits. And so I think that's a challenge. I think one thing that we don't know but that has the potential there is that LeVar more than likely met some good people who had some of these skills and abilities if he was really paying attention during his own collegiate experience. And that's one of the benefits from going to an educational institution, is that you can rub up against people and meet people who have these skills and abilities. And so time will tell about if this is truly the case in the situation of LeVar Ball and Big Baller Brand. But I think that some of the places that he's been, he should have had enough proximity to people who have those skills and abilities that there's a good chance that he's been able to connect.
Yeah, I think you hit it right on. Bob Wynn, who runs Pro Square, who we partner with on events, and you know, Bob has been big pushing on this, on the financial literacy, building capital. But one of the things that Bob often talks about, particularly specifically in the Black community, is when he's talking about even building investment groups, is that, you know, this idea of trust. And in part of what I this is why I want you to talk about, because part of the part that I hear about, for the one thing that worries me when I hear LeVar speak, is over protection, this kind of trust piece, that he wants to control things in a way that doesn't give me insight to whether or not he has that kind of team, right? It almost feels Trumpian in a sense. That, you know, in some ways Trump was successful as a business person, but, you know, he did it a different way. And he had a certain level of social capital that allowed him to navigate through spaces that LeVar Ball is not going to be able to do. And so, but there's this idea of not being able to trust and partner in ways that will move you from a micro business, small business, medium size to a multinational company in a way that you see how LeBron and them are building their team in their networks and something like that, right? And so, you know, whether or not he has the, which means sometimes you got to sit back and take the screen, right? Sometimes that's not
right.
You coming down and taking a shot. Sometimes that means you just kind of over and letting somebody else move the piece for you, right? I think LeBron is a master at that. I think his whole crew is a master at that, running that stuff the way they do it. And so, and that to me is something that has much more of a cultural piece there that you and I have seen when we try to work in communities. You know, even some of the stuff I've done in, you know, economic development spaces where it was just hard for people to see that collaborative space and worry about what they're going to be losing, right? And does that make sense?
Right.
Maybe, and maybe if it doesn't, man, can you unpack that a little bit? Because how do you help someone in that space get past that?
Yeah. Well, I think often when you have folks who come from marginalized communities, the margin of error, at least the perceived margin of error, is smaller. So, you know, the feeling that if this doesn't work, then I don't know if I'm going to get a second shot, then that kind of makes people more risk averse. And then, you know, one of the consequences of being a little risk averse is the feeling that, hey, I better have total control over this because I can make it work. And sometimes folks' skills and abilities can get a concept to a certain point, but then you need a different entity to come in to help you take it to the next level. I was even thinking about Joe Jackson. You know, he could take his sons to a certain point, right? But then when he hit that one point, then he needed a Berry Gordy, right?
That's right.
And then
right.
Even after they were able to go beyond Motown to Epic, for Michael to really become the just super mega star, they had to move even beyond Joe Jackson's management. You know,
you're hitting it right on the head right there. Keep it going.
And so I would probably argue that there will come a point in time where if this is really going to be a big success, there'll be a different role for LeVar. His skills and abilities might have been just to create enough attention around what's going on in order to get them into the consciousness. And then you might need someone else to take you to the next step. I think even of Jay-Z with Roc Nation, where it's a whole team of folks who are doing that, and eventually they were able to branch out. And they're representing athletes and entertainers in a variety of different ways that go beyond the initial expertise of Jay-Z. And he was able to get some good people around him.
That's right. I mean, even when you think about their partner Biggs, who, when you hear that guy talk, I mean, he's the one who really pushed the idea of Roc Nation. So they had a really good team around it. Our concept of, even if it's a small group, you know, who's his brain trust? And maybe he has the brain trust, and he's, like, protecting that brain trust. He just, like, I want to be out front, and people don't need to know who the brain trust is. And so that's something, like you said, we'll learn more. One of the things I wanted, like, one of the key things that people brought up, and you and I kind of talked about this off the air, because, again, it's a perspective that we wouldn't have in other ways we look at this. So you have everybody saying, well, you know, they only made $150,000 or whatever in the first day. And, again, you know, if you're thinking about it from a business perspective, anybody who was great started from something. They didn't move all those units on the first day. Rarely do people come out and move. You know, it was like it was a process you built. And so how do you get around that part of it? Because everybody's like, well, you better – because I think they're still concentrating on the $2 million they think he lost. So, I mean, how do you get around that kind of – I mean, I kind of looked at it like, well, that's what happens in business. You know, you got to start somewhere, right?
Yeah.
How do you get around that part of it?
I think the way they get around it is that essentially they're betting on, in this initial phase, they're betting on Lonzo. And so one way you get around it is if he plays great, then he makes the money up anyway. If he doesn't play great and you learn a whole bunch from this venture, the expertise you get can be applied in the next venture. Because the next venture that they have in mind might not even be shoes. And so that type of expertise is invaluable, you know, because I always think about, when I think about entrepreneurship, I always think how people start very simply and then they're able to expand. You know, I think about how in the old days where you had rappers who were selling mixtapes out of the trunk of their cars, and some of them were able to leverage that into having their own distribution deals, right? Now, I would imagine that the first time they were selling stuff out of the trunk of their cars, some people didn't do that well. You know, no one might have bought it and what have you. And, you know, they had some days where they were hungry. But then they learned a lot from those days where they were hungry, and then they were able to use that expertise. And sometimes that expertise is valuable. I mean, in fact, people pay a lot of college tuition to business schools to get that type of expertise. And so, this is almost like a high level apprenticeship, but one where they're kind of setting their own terms.
Now, one of the things, if I were to put at it, he does have a roadmap. You know, if we think about what Stephon did with the Starberries, you know, now, you know, the thing that Stephon was trying to do it for a great cause, but. You know, you can talk about this more as an economist, but at certain price points, there's a perception of value, even though his shoes were quality. So I thought he could take maybe a Starberry model with a mid-range price point. So obviously, there's a roadmap to how you set the deal up, right? Mm-hmm. He has relationships with certain stores, and you know, maybe he's not at the $400 price point. He's in $175. $200 price point, and your sandals are at $100, whatever. You're right, but it's at a reasonable price point. I mean, I wonder why he didn't take that model, which is already there, and it just it's kind of supersized it.
I was wondering about that too, because that's an easier point of entry. The one thing that I would say that there might have been such that there's enough competition in that segment already where they felt then they couldn't directly go against that competition. And so they had to do something that was novel, almost creating it as a luxury brand in order to get into a space where they felt that it wasn't so much market competition by the existing shoe companies.
You're saying that they want to be in a space where they were going to create their own rare competition in that space.
Because you're almost creating a brand. You're almost creating that brand out of thin air. You know, you think about even the Kardashians, right? They didn't really start off by trying to sell products that were in the mid price range.
Yes.
Everything gave the illusion that it was super high quality that only certain people could access. And that was kind of their entry point. And we've even seen that sometimes with companies who they'll market a luxury item, and then after they've hit a certain amount of success, they'll release a second brand under a different name that will go at the mid-price model.
See, this is what you get, y'all, on One Mic. This is you don't get this anywhere else on Sports Talk Show Radio. This is RSG One Mic podcast. This is A Baller's Life. We're talking about LeVar Ball and the Ball family and how they are pushing to change the game and to change the shift in power. And so there's a couple things I want to hit, as we close, and we're here with Dr. Richard McGregory, who's an economist, an educator, you know, as a non-for-profit, has worked with communities, has worked with K through 12 setting and higher ed, and has a unique perspective and offers some really good gems. You know, if you have, if you're just entering this conversation, you want to hear it in its entirety, check us out on iTunes, subscribe, you know, give us some feedback. You can also get to us through realsportsguys.com and check it out as well. A couple of quick things. One of the things I did have a concern about, you and I grew up in this spirit, in this era, particularly when Jordan shoes came out, and how those luxury items ended up in violence in certain communities. Because one thing different about the Kardashians is there's a certain level of clientele that's buying those items,
right?
That are probably in the same social strata as they are. Whereas historically, shoes like this have, there are people across the strata that have wanted to access these items, which has then caused some violence in spaces, from kids getting beat up, shot for shoes. Do we worry about the impact in some of these urban environments when you have something that is, when somebody's wearing shoes like that down the street, that makes them a target?
I would agree that there's always a level of concern. One thing that I have seen in terms of tennis shoes is that more people now are buying shoes as collector items than actually buying them to wear.
Yes.
And the price point where they're at might be in that kind of realm. And so that's where I'm wondering, because I think that you might not get as many pairs of shoes that are out there, and so they might be so rare that it won't be cause for concern, because people won't even really see that product on people within those neighborhoods. That type of product might stay in the box, and then people kind of using it kind of to speculate about, you know, how well Lonzo's going to do, and if he does well, then that $495 shoe then becomes a $2,000 value, or if he doesn't do well, it has no value at all. And so there's a lot of different ways that it can come, but I think we should always be concerned about any items in these communities. I think part of the issue is that we have rarely in these communities had a talk about the type of ostentatious items that we purchase, and to have a rational conversation about, is it worth it? You know, I think about even, I have a nephew who's 14, and a family shopping trip, and I saw him really aggressively looking for these expensive jeans that already had holes in them. And I just thought in my mind about what does this really say about how our mentality as a society, you know, where, you know, we're gonna jack up the price of something that really poor kids typically had to wear, and then we're going to make that a designer item that everyone has to have, you know, and what kind of weird, to me strange, psychological dynamics are informing the marketing, and so I worry about that type of ostentatious consumption in general, but I think in many of our communities now, there are so many different things that are causing violence that I think it would be hard to pinpoint it solely to a particular shoe, and I think there's so many different types of shoes out there now that it's a little bit more diffuse. So at one time, folks had to have the Air Jordans because that was the only shoe that they were looking at. Well, now there might be 2, 3, 4 different brands and some brands that might be close enough that are pricing the midpoint and what have you, to where I think is not the same concern, even though we should always continue paying attention to what's going on in terms of the consumer purchases and what does that really say to our mentality as individuals and as communities.
You listen to RSG One Mic. This is our show where we go deep into a sports topic, and usually it's a topic that is hot on most people's minds, and we take it in a different direction. And if you haven't had a chance to listen to this, please, you got to listen. This is a great one. We're here with Dr. Richard McGregory, Jr., who is an economist, educator, head of a not-for-profit, has a unique perspective on these things, and I'd say avid sports lover that is very important. You know, as we think to the future, you know, what I like to do, and I always tell my students, like, you have to think with the end in mind, that you are thinking about being successful. So let's say successful. How does that change the practices of the big shoe companies if you start to see a trend developing here? How do they set the game up differently? How do they not like this, let this take on a life of its own? Or is there enough room for both approaches to operate?
I think if it's successful, initially there'll be room for two different models to coexist for a while simultaneously, but I think it has the potential of changing the whole industry. I think about even when you look at the media and how now that you can kind of set up your own media outlets, particularly on the internet, for a much lower cost in terms of the cost of entry. You can set up things with less equipment to get going. How that's had a profound impact, particularly on newspaper, and how now you see more and more newspapers going out of business, and how the new business models have drastically impacted the media. I was even seeing something the other day about how the predictions for media companies will be that you will find them on the internet. You will not find them in print, or you won't find them with all of the overhead and capital expenses to start radio, your own radio stations, because you can do so many different things in cyberspace. And so I think that if this model is successful, it has that same potential of eating away at the traditional shoe companies. And so I think that's something that they're going to have to pay attention to. You know, because even though we think, well, that couldn't happen because Nike's multi-billion-dollar company, but it's happened more and more in different spheres. And once we didn't think that record companies would be impacted by different models of distributing music, and then, you know, we got to the situation where, hey, you can release an album directly online. Now we don't even talk about somebody being a multi-platinum seller, of music. We talk about the amount of downloads, right?
Yes.
We don't even think anymore in terms of complete albums, right?
Mm.
Or complete tapes or complete CDs. We think of a song, you know.
Well, hey.
And
I'm
so,
over here going crazy, man. You are doing your thing. I was going to tell you, I got to bring you back. I got to bring you back. I'm not even going to let you do any more because we're giving them too much tonight. You've done too much for me tonight. You know, when I put this out here, you've done your thing. This is Dr. Richard McGregory. I'm just going to tell y'all, I'm not going to let him go. He's at the tip of the iceberg of this, and he's going to be a regular contributor on One Mic. And I want to thank you for being here with me tonight, because I don't want you to go too much deeper, because I want to bring you back. Will you come back?
Oh, yes, definitely. Definitely. And definitely enjoy the experience, and always like talking and thinking through these things, because I think the more that we can have the intellectual discourse, I think then you'll see more models develop. and that will help transform communities. Because I think that when you look at the average young person, they got access to so many different things where they're really walking around with just arm's length from having their own businesses right with them.
Well, we're going to go deeper in this. Thank you for being on RSG One Mic with us. You know, we're definitely going to have you here for other topics. And for our listeners, hey, catch us again. You catch the big show. We'll be coming back with Marcus and Phil. You know, that's like where faculty seminar meets the barbershop. You never know what's going to happen. To check out Hustle and Flow. That's the intersection between hip-hop and sports. You know, we'll be bringing more to you on these platforms of Real Sports Guys. I'm looking forward to being at the Wisconsin Sports Awards show here. You'll check us out on social media. I'll be giving some shout-outs there. I hope we get a chance to see, as Stephen A. Smith said, the bad man, Aaron Rodgers. Hopefully I'll get a chance to see him as well. Thank you again. Until next time, this is RSG.